This podcast is sponsored by Jobber Business Software. Jobber is an online business software that can be implemented into any style of business, but it works especially well for arborist companies. I use it in my own business and it has made such a huge difference. I own and run quite a small tree company, so I didn't know that it would be that much help and like how much more time it's going to save me on the admin side, because I didn't feel like I had a lot. But as soon as I started implementing it, it saves me so much time just from doing quotes on the app out on site when I'm actually on the property, to then being able to invoice as soon as I get in my truck from completing a job. It means that I don't forget to send invoices, which I have been guilty of in the past and probably lost quite a lot of money from. It also lets you manage your crews, so all of your crew can have the app on their phone, and once that person is selected for a specific job on the desktop version, that person, once they open their app, will see the job, will see all the details, will see the client's information, and it can be restricted also on how much detail they see if you don't want them to see the cost of the job, all that kind of stuff. It's very versatile. And it's absolutely amazing software, and it's really changed the way that I run my business. It's just made everything just so much easier. So if you want to try out Jobber, then the best thing to do is go to the website, climbingarborist.com, and you'll see the link, the image for Jobber across the top of the page. If you click on that link, what that will get you is a 14-day free trial, but it'll also get you 20% off your first 6 months subscription. So go to the climbingarborist.com website, click on the Jobber banner, and you'll get 14-day free trial, and you'll also get 6 months subscription at 20% discount. I can't say enough about Jobber. It's been absolutely fantastic for me using it so far, and I couldn't imagine going back to the Stone Age way that I was running my business before. This podcast was recorded on location from the Jobber booth at the TCI Expo 2019. My guest for this podcast is Phil Kelly. Phil has been an arborist for many, many years, and he's been a contract climber. He's been a trainer for North American Training Solutions, and he's most recently taken a job at Wright's Tree Service in a safety role. Phil talks about how he got into the industry, his first few years. He talks about an accident that he had that kind of changed his career path, talked about becoming a trainer and what's been involved in the training role ever since, and his new role at Wright's Tree Service. So I hope you enjoy the podcast. Thanks for listening. So you've not been doing anything with naps this morning?
No, I'm not really doing anything with them, just on a really small scale now.
All right, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I kicked the can down the road.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, yeah. So I'm still, by virtue, I'm still with them, but I haven't done any training for them. I've kind of done just transitioned into something else.
Okay.
Hope that doesn't mean you don't want to interview me.
No. Okay. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, we can.
Yeah, yeah.
For sure.
Do you kick the can
down the road? Yeah.
Like, for what reason?
More for personal reasons, like... The role that I had within the company was super high demand and spent a lot of time on the road, and with the family, the girls are getting to that age where they needed more of my time, and even when I was home, because of all the different avenues that I was doing with Nats, I wasn't able to spend time with them. I'd be on my computer looking at my phone, like it wasn't really quality time. So, and then I was looking at like long term, what was going to happen like 20 years from now. And did I have, like, if you're thinking about retirement goals, when you get to my age, you got to start really looking at how what's going to happen when you can't climb and you're too old. And so I was looking to find a program that 20 years from now I can just, if I choose to, which I probably won't, but if I choose to, I could quit working and financially be stable. And that path wasn't probably going to allow that to happen without a lot of big changes. And so I found a company that offered that, but still allowed me to do my passion, which is the training and teaching and education.
Yep.
And I also was able to relieve some of the other responsibilities. So now when I'm home, I can be 100% at home, turn
Wicked.
The phone off and do the dad thing for sure. So yeah. that was a big crucial thing.
Well, I'm sure when you have a child, everything changes, like every single aspect of your life. And so when it comes to work, you have to figure out what's important and what's going to work best for you and family and all that kind of stuff. So
yeah. Then when you have three, it becomes even worse.
Oh, you got three. Yeah. Wow.
So
wow.
When you have all of that, it becomes like with three in the house and life's just full of, you know, and as they start to grow and mature in their own ways, the demands become very different, you know. So sporting events and life events, and so, you know, so that when they're all in the household and they're all doing their thing, you gotta be present.
Yeah,
it's okay to be away.
That's for sure.
But when you're away, you're away. But when you're home,
you can't be kind of gone with the fairies doing other things. And
yes.
Yeah. So cheers for joining me anyway, Phil.
Yep.
Much appreciated. So tell me a little bit about yourself and how you got started in the tree industry in the first place, really, and kind of the path that it's taken you on up till now, I suppose.
Yeah. So I started back, I was 17, and I was graduated from high school and started college, and I had met a girl who I thought was the awesomest thing in the world, and as we all do at 17, and we ended up getting married, and then I realized that I needed a job and that school probably wasn't the best choice for me. So I met somebody that asked me if I wanted to climb trees, and I thought that was great, doing line clearance work, and so I did that. So I took a job with them, making $3.95 an hour, and that was a better wage than I could make at McDonald's, so I was in. And so that's how I started. And then I did that for 6 or 7 years, and I went to a training put on by Rip Tompkins, Arbor Master, back in the late 90s, and after doing it for a few years, and decided after I saw that, I realized that there was this whole big world that I hadn't ever seen before, being stuck in this small Midwest line clearance mentality. And so I thought, you know, whatever Rip was doing, I wanted to try that. So I became a certified arborist and left and moved to Atlanta with the family and started there instead, and did commercial residential stuff for a while. And then I met Scott Prophet, and he started Nats, and I got invited to go to a Train the Trainer. And this was shortly after I had my major accident. So I was looking, I was kind of adrift, looking for something to do, some way to continue to be involved in the industry, but in a different way, because I couldn't be a production climber day in and day out anymore. And so I went to the Train the Trainer, and apparently that went really well. So Scott asked me to go start being involved in trainings, and I just kept bugging him enough that he couldn't get rid of me. And eventually took a full-time role with Nats, and worked with Nats all the way after Ed bought it and became vice president, and continued to grow and develop that. Moved out to the West Coast and had a contract climbing business and was doing Nats stuff. And that's when I started doing a lot of speaking and going out in the industry and doing more than just training, but really trying to get involved to make a difference. And and then about a year and a half ago, as I was saying, I made a transition from Nats into a role with Right Tree Service. And it was looking at, functionally, what could I do for myself and my family, but also kind of looking at, as I spent a lot of time with Nats traveling, I was doing like 290 days a year on the road. And what I realized is that when I go out to do these trainings or go to conferences, I was seeing the same people over and over. And it's always that top 4 or 5% people that are showing up that are certified arborists that need to get the training. And so I thought, well, am I really influencing this industry as much as my original dream was? Because the idea was, after I got hurt, I really wanted to provide something back to the industry that had given so much to me, and make sure that nobody ended up in the same position I was in.
So what, just to stop you there, so was your accident work related?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
Do you want to talk a little bit about
that? Yeah, I was doing a large crane removal. And I had walked out a branch. I was probably 45, 50 feet away from the tree stem, and the branch failed from underneath me. So I swung through the air and slammed into the tree, and I shattered 27 fractures in my right arm and my right elbow and a shoulder dislocation and a couple of ribs. And then they put me back together. They put a plate and all the screws back in, and I went a couple months and then started climbing, and I was feeling a lot of pain. So I went back to the doctor and said, this isn't working, something's wrong. So they went back in, and what was happening was the bone pieces in between had collapsed, and so the plate had shifted. And every time I opened my arm, the plate was rubbing against the upper part of the upper bone in my arm. So they went in, and they removed a couple inches off the end of my elbow, the radial head, and they took out part of the bone coming down, and they took out part of the inside of the elbow. And so there's nothing there structurally anymore holding that together. And so when I left the hospital that day after that second surgery, and it was literally a year apart between the two surgeries, and he said, you know, you're never going to climb trees again. You're done.
Shit.
And he said, you're never, like, you can only lift, my restriction at that time was you can only lift 30 pounds with your right arm once a day. So you can do 10 pounds three times or 6 pounds five times, but that's it. That's all you got. And, you know, to walk home that, you know, well, to go home that day and look around and realize, like, there's no other path. I'm in my mid-30s. I've done nothing but this since I was 17. I'm not qualified for anything else. And I really, really love doing this. And so just figuring out ways to overcome that and figuring out ways to do this job better. And then just wanting to share that ability with everyone else to say, like, We can be safer. We can be smarter. You cannot do what I did. If I just share some of this experience with you, we can all be a better industry. So that was kind of the idea when I went to train the trainer, is what can I give back? And I was really, again, searching for something to, because I was lost. Like, if you take everything I was to that moment, I was a tree climber. That was my whole identity. Everything I'd ever known or wanted to be was just the most awesome tree climber I could be, and now
probably felt like that was just kind of pulled from under you, and you were like, gosh, like, where do I go from here, kind of thing, and like, what are the options? And I suppose it, most tree climbers, if you've never sat and thought about what if I do have an accident, like, where would I go at that point, if you've never thought about it, it's quite a scary thought, because you just feel like you go to work every day. That's what you do. That is your job. And to most people, like, say my wife, if she had an accident while doing a hobby she liked, she could probably still go to work the next day because she worked in an office. But you or I, if you have an accident either at work or outside of work, there's a good chance you're pretty screwed, especially maybe even a week or a couple of weeks, or depending on how serious it is. But it's going to stop you doing your job for no matter what happens, really. So.
Well, I think the other thing that I find interesting with arborists, that, you know, all arborists I've ever met, is this is more than just a job. Like, a lot of people can show up to an office every day and that's, you know, that's what they do. And for most of us, this isn't what we do. This is literally who we are. We identify ourselves and our whole pride, our whole internal sense of whom we are is built around the fact that we are tree climbers. We're arborists. We're physically working, and there's something about that culture that we really becomes ingrained in all parts of our home life too. Like, we carry everything with us, and so when that sense, you're literally, your entire sense of identity, who you are, becomes, it just disappears underneath you in a snap of a finger, and you're left to look around like, this is all I've ever done, and this is all I've ever wanted to do, because it is who I am. It's not, I don't punch a time clock. Most arborists don't, right? We do if you did it for money, we would have found a better job, right? And that's the honor, because it's a hard job, and you're in the elements, and we all know that. Like, if you don't love the suck, you're going to quit within the first 6 months. And then there's that part of the brain that we can all, like, somehow we can overcome the suck and find a good time in the middle of it, and we just keep coming back. And then when you take that all away, there's no other job that will give you the sense of accomplishment or satisfaction. It, to me, at least, that we have now. So to have that ripped away violently, it's more than just not having a paycheck. It's a complete personal, very heart, very at your core, like, who am I now?
And so how long after you had your accident, so had you been doing stuff with gnats before that?
Nope.
No.
No.
So that came afterwards.
Yeah.
So you went to train the trainer afterwards?
Yeah. So yeah. I was hurt in 2007. First surgery, second surgery, 2008. Was just getting back into climbing and went to train the trainer in 2009. And that was my first. I'd known Scott Proffitt and worked with Scott for a long time. When I first moved to Atlanta, he's actually the person that hired me and moved me to Atlanta to work for a tree care company. And then he left that company and went off and did some stuff with Cheryl and then developed Nats. And so, and Nats had been going for 2 years. Well, right around the time I got hurt initially, Nats started up. And so in 2009, they had this event where they were trying to bring in more trainers, try to widen the pool and share some knowledge. And I was one of the people that was invited by one of the instructors that was already there. They called it a golden ticket, like Willy Wonka, right? So I got a golden ticket from a good friend of mine who said, you know, they asked him, they said, look, we'll give you one golden ticket for you. Go find someone that you think's going to fit, like, within this, what we're trying to create, that has the right whatever. And so I got the golden ticket from a friend of mine, and that's how I ended up at train the trainer. And then, like I said, that was the first catalyst. And you went there not with all the idea of being a Nats trainer, which some people really wanted to be, and some people just wanted the experience of being in this environment, learning how to teach, learning how to train, but they didn't want to do anything beyond that. And I was in there not sure what I wanted to do. And about halfway through that week, which was extremely intense, I realized, like, that the epiphany was that this is what I should be doing. This is where I could go. And so then when I left there, it was like I said, I was probably more like a gnat in Scott's ear, just constantly bugging him about whatever opportunity I could get to go out and do this awesome thing that's called training. Yeah.
And you, so when you started doing training, did you instantly feel kind of the accomplishment of getting a message across to a variety of different arborists? Like, because with Nats, where would you do training? Like, in what scenarios? Do they do private companies? Do they do big shows like the TTI and that kind of stuff? What was their... Do they have like a main client or a main focus about who they're going to train?
No, well, that's evolved for sure. So in 2009, I think the main client was actually doing the Vermeer seminars. And then they had a few smaller clients that were private. So, but they were bigger companies like that were wanting training at a field level. And then as we got going and as we started working at this and spreading the name, you know, Otis Sisk and I were probably on the road forever for a couple of years. And that's when we started coming to, from the Vermeer trainings, we'd meet people that said, hey, I'd love for you to come to my place of business and do something for, I got two crews, it's a small mom and pop. And that's who we're really trying to focus on is those kind of, you know, the Vermeer seminars are a great catalyst to bring out the awareness of where we, of what training can be, but it's not really fair to call it, it's more of an education, right? It's an educational event because training requires more than just standing around watching somebody do something.
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of an intro into what Nats could do, I suppose.
Yeah.
And then you could get more in-depth training, which I suppose that's what you're hoping for, like a small company inviting you in for a day or two to show their guys how to do whatever it is they want training on. Yeah.
And that's how it started. So we started doing, my first training was for a larger company, a utility company in the Carolinas. And I showed up and there was a group of four of us. And it was, I felt overwhelmed and intimidated, like, because I knew the knowledge and I knew what I wanted. I knew how to do the task that I was trying to teach them to do, but my ability to communicate that message effectively was definitely not where I hoped it would be. Because you come from an environment where I'd been doing work on a crew for years, right? And you go out with the same crew every day and you train and teach your crew in that environment, whoever they may be, but you've got months of time to build a relationship and gain trust and show them the intricacies. And now you've got one day to do all of that. You got one day to earn their trust, their respect, get them to believe in you, and then empower them to feel confident in what you're showing them. And that is something that I think really defines what training is, you know, because all of us probably at some point, if we've done this long enough, you know, we could really, we understand how to do something and we know all the intricacies, but to be able to communicate exactly how to do that to somebody else, and each person learns differently. So some people are very visual, some people are very physical, they need to touch it, some people need to hear it, some people need all of those things, and then to be able to recognize the audience for who they are, I think that's probably, for me, took the longest time. So for me to say that I was a good trainer, I would say that I was on the road for 2 years struggling hard at bigger events like Vermeer and stuff before I learned how to deliver a message to an audience. And once you learn how to deliver a message to a big audience, it becomes easier to dial it down when you do this smaller training. So I think the ultimate goal of Nats would be to raise an awareness at a bigger events like these or conferences and stuff, and then from there bring it down into a more hands-on level where we can one-on-one really show you what that awareness can equal as far as improvements in your ability to perform the task safely and efficiently, right? And I think for me, the greatest reward ever is when, you know, you and I can have a conversation and I can explain something to you that you've been thinking about or working through for months, and all of a sudden, for some reason, whatever I said made complete sense to you, and you're like, it's that
the light bulb go,
moment, yeah. And you're like, and I'm like, oh, that's it. That was the win. And that win is probably worth a million great crane jobs, right?
Yeah.
That sense of satisfaction.
Yeah. And it's that, like, I really admire trainers, especially the ones that when you sit down and listen to them and watch them present, just kind of just captivate you, and you've been in there 45 minutes before you know it, and like you're just kind of taking everything in, because like you'll know it's so hard to be able to hold people's attention and present something in a way where everybody understands, and it's such an art form to like to be able to do that. And you know, like you said, we all kind of have experience and have been, you know, if you've been working the job a few years, you could kind of teach you co-workers, but because you have that rapport already, you don't have to build that, and to be able to do that to a complete stranger and have them trust you and be able to hold their attention and explain something that they completely get without even knowing you as a person, it takes a lot of skill. I don't know how somebody can teach you how to communicate in that way, but it's that's the challenge, isn't it, as a trainer, really?
And it is a challenge. I think the biggest thing about being a trainer is you have to be able to, you already know how to do whatever it is you're training, hopefully, or you shouldn't be doing the training. But and then what you need to understand is how to deliver that message in a palatable way. But you need to be able to read the audience, where they're at, and recognize where they're at in your journey, right? But I think the biggest thing that I had to learn from a training perspective is that there's a point where you have to, you give more energy and you give more away than you'll ever get back as a trainer. And if you're not, like, at the end of the day, like after that 1 hour session this morning or at the end of the day, I am 10 times more exhausted after a day of training or an hour of training than I would have been doing a crane removal, because you have to provide that energy to the people, and they have to ride the wave of your energy to understand what you're trying to say. And so it is one of the most challenging jobs I've ever done, probably, and one of the most physically and mentally exhausting.
Mentally exhausting, that's for sure. Yeah, because you have to prepare everything that you're about to teach, and then you have to be so switched on and focused, and you know, and kind of have eye contact with everybody you're presenting to, and you just got to engage the whole time, and it is mentally exhausting, definitely. And another thing you said there is that people will take so much more away from it than kind of what you'll take away, if you know what I mean. And I did a podcast with with Mark Prithkirat, I think that's his name. Who does the splicing, and he learned to splice from Rich Hattier, and he said the things that he learned from Rich, which would have been just what Rich knew at the time and what Rich knew about splicing at the time and would seem kind of almost second nature to him, Mark said that that just absolutely blew his mind, and he took so much away from that. And then now Mark teaches other people. I was saying, yeah, but that feeling that you got from learning from Rich will be what other people get from learning from you, but you'll never see that because kind of they'll just go away and be like, oh my God, so he showed me how to do this, that and the other. And but Mark will never kind of have that feeling because they're the ones that are learning from him. So
but to not undersell the coolest thing about teaching that I have learned for sure is that, yes, I give more away from a physical, emotional, mental level, because you are the biggest thing about a great instructor is his ability to, yes, plan and prepare, but also to adapt to the audience standing in front of him. Because I can have the greatest speech and prepare the greatest speech and have the best information, right, and have it all written out, and I can stand in front of you and I can talk like this the whole time with no emotion and totally ignore whatever you're doing, or I can interact with you and involve you and make it about you and read you, and then and in a moment's notice, if we're not going down a path that's working, I need to be able to shift and pause and redirect all of us, right? And that's the difference between someone that's preaching and someone that's teaching, right? Because we have people that preach to us and tell us what they know.
Yep.
And then we have people that teach us who tell us what we all want to learn, right? But the biggest thing for me is what I've learned from teaching, and this is completely, instructing is totally selfish, and the fact that the greatest way for me to learn anything is to have to teach it to you.
Yeah.
Right? Because I can sit and listen and I can do all this other stuff, but the second I have to stand in front of you and teach you how to do something, then I have to become a master of it on my own.
Yeah.
And I have to learn all these different ways to deliver that information to you, so I become a field expert on that subject if I want to be a good instructor or a good teacher. So teaching, actually, the reward in teaching is I become more knowledgeable.
Yeah.
Yeah. And to me, I've learned so many incredible things just from people asking me, hey, can you teach this? And, you know, like biomechanics. Hey, Phil, can you talk about biomechanics? I have no idea what biomechanics meant 9 months ago. And today, I knew a lot more about biomechanics. And what I realized is I need to know even more about biomechanics. But that was the journey, right? And so if you've ever been in that opportunity, had that opportunity where it's something within your wheelhouse, but it might be just a little bit outside of what you're comfortable with, that's the greatest way to learn anything is to teach it to another person.
Yeah. I had that recently, actually. I've just been kind of training a girl called Ali for tree climbing competitions, and she's very new to climbing. She's like 10 months in. So as I'm kind of teaching her various different techniques and different styles and, you know, how to move around a tree, it's funny because I'm breaking it down for her. So in breaking it down for her, I'm actually breaking it down for myself in a way that I'd never thought about climbing before. But because I've got to break it down into small sections so as not to like overwhelm, I'm like, oh yeah, this kind of makes sense. And it even kind of, it's like you're teaching yourself a little bit more, because you're rather than just going through the motions, you're breaking it down into kind of bite-sized pieces that you can analyze a little more than you ever would if you were just doing it for yourself at work, kind of thing.
And the great thing about working with someone that's completely different from you physically and mentally, who has a different set of experiences, and is that you're looking at something and it's worked for you forever, but you don't know why you do
it. Yeah.
You've just done it. And then they ask you, well, why do you do it like that? And you're like, well, because this is, and then you think about it and then you watch them and you're like, but that'll never work for you. So now I have to think about not only why I'm doing it, but how I can make it work for you. And so then you start to look at adapting the end result, but the process to get to the end result. So you're looking at all the processes, and yeah, you're right. You're breaking it down, and you really are, like, it's 3-minute segments, right? That's what it comes down to. Like Hollywood, if you watch a movie, It's something new every 3 minutes because they figured out that that's the attention span of the average person. And so when you're breaking down at something and instruction-wise, it's a three-minute block before you move to.
Right.
And you don't even know you're doing it, but it's true because that's how long you can focus.
Yeah. And then so you completely switch it onto something else. And
Yeah.
And so how do you, when you're training, how do you field people's questions? Like, obviously you've got to be interactive with the people that you're training, but how do you not go off topic so much as to just kind of derail your whole training course?
So that's always the challenge, right? So it's kind of one of those old teaching things where you identify there's three types of students, right? There's volunteers, people that are super enthusiastic, really engaged, and like they're the ones that can derail the whole thing. So you got to recognize who they are right up front. And then you have people that are vacationers who are there because the boss paid them to be there, and they're just literally there to wait for 4 o'clock when they can start drinking. And they're just going to suffer through. And this is, to them, it's a vacation. It's a day where they don't have to do their normal thing. And then you have prisoners, which are people that feel like they're forced to be there. And those are the ones that also can be very distracting because they can be argumentative and combative. And recognizing that of the three groups of, when you're standing in front of a group of people, you have to recognize who's where. But then you also have to recognize that of all of those groups, the vacationers are the worst ones, but they're also the quietest because they're apathetic. And so you don't focus too much on them because they're not providing a value to the whole group. And so the way I look at it, if I have a volunteer, an extremely eager volunteer, what I do is engage them to the point 90% of the time you give them a task so that they're busy with their hands, which distracts them from asking questions. You make them part of the training. Hey, can you come over here and hold this rope? Because I'm going to cut this piece, and this is a super important job. So I just need you to be really quiet and listen while I'm doing this, and just make sure you're ready. And instantly, they're on board. They're in the game, and they don't want to let you down. And they're part of it, so they feel really good. And that generally shuts that down. Or what else I'll do with someone that's very enthusiastic with questions, I'll say, look, I appreciate everything you're asking, and to be perfectly honest, like, that's coming up in just a couple minutes. If you let me get there, like, I'm building right towards that, and I'm so excited that you thought of it first. So the biggest thing is always compliment them, because if you shut them down, you disengage them, which is probably what you're looking for, but what you don't recognize is all the people that were afraid of getting involved, they're kind of on the fence, didn't know how you would respond, they're nervous about being, as soon as you shut that person down, they're like, well, if he did that to him, then I'm just not going to say anything because this, he's totally not responding.
Yeah, it's kind of make or break. If you shut them down, then they're not going to want to respond, whereas if you kind of compliment them and be like, great question, we'll get there, then it will kind of encourage other people to maybe comment later on down the line, and you never know, their comments might hold even more weight, and then they might be more important. So you want to engage.
If you shut somebody down, it makes the rest of the group feel like, well, if I say something, he's just going to shut me down, so I'm not going to be bothering interacting. And you know, 99% of the time, the best class I have is the one where I don't teach anything. So whether you know it or not, you've hit the pinnacle of education when you introduce an idea and the class teaches
itself.
When someone asks you a question, you're like, you know what, that's a great question. Does anybody have the answer to that? And then you let it build on itself, and now the students are teaching the students, and you're basically moderating. And that's really how you win, because then you get interaction and involvement, and they become the teachers. And if they're the teachers, that means that's their opportunity to learn even more, because you learn the most when you're teaching. And so that's what I do with the volunteers. Either get them involved or ask them, you know, tell them that it's coming. But I always thank them. Thank you. Right? Never do anything but thank them and appreciate them, because the more you do that, the more other people will volunteer. And then the prisoners, generally 99% of the time, they're a prisoner because of something else that's going on in their world that has nothing to do with you. And so if you just sit them down, and what we call it is like, you as is it, you just make it real and just be like, look, I understand that this is happening over here, but does it really have anything to do with what we're talking about today? have I done anything, or is this about anybody in this room? Because if it's not, can we just curb it for today? Can we just curb it? Can we just move on? Because we can do great things together, and you can provide something to this class. As long as we recognize that that is an issue, but it's not today's issue. And most people will, they'll pause, they'll
set
think
something
about,
aside, and
they'll come back to you.
And then they'll get way more out of that whole course than they would have done before. Because if they, yeah, if they can put something aside and absorb all the information and get something out of it and be part of it, then they're going to take way more away than they would have done before.
I think for me, what I found is I actually enjoy having the prisoners in the class. If I can identify them early, because they become your greatest volunteers. Once they understand that you're actually there for them and whatever, and usually it's an issue between them and the company or them and the boss or something like that, right? And it's not a personal attack against you. And you get them to understand that I actually care about whatever it is you're talking about, but I'm more importantly, I just care about you as a person. Then they become, at the end of the class, they're the ones that's gonna give you the greatest handshake and tell you thanks so much. And so I find I really love that prisoner mentality, because they are the best volunteers. Yeah.
Wicked. And so now you work for Right Tree Service?
Yep.
In a training capacity?
Yeah. Yeah. So my job is, there's, you know, it's a big, very large company. So my job is, so I worked for Rights in 1990, whatever, a long time ago. And I worked for them for a couple of years, and then I left and I did the Nats thing, and the vice president or the CFO of Right Tree Service came up to me and said, you know, I've been watching you for a long time, and we want to do something different, and we want to change the way we're doing safety and training, because right now it's not working and we're growing and we're just not winning, and we don't have a job title, we don't have a job description, but we know that it'd be great if you could come on board, we could do some good stuff. And I went home and I thought about it, and I was saying earlier, like, you know, from a NATS training, it's the 3 or 4%. It's the people that are certified arborists that are showing up, that are doing the trainings and doing the stuff. And that's great. And I appreciate and love all of that. But if I truly want to make a difference in this industry, if you think about the size of like Wrights or Aspen or Davey, those guys that are out there grinding it, or even some Bartlett stuff, you know, that's the largest workforce in the United States doing tree care. And they're the ones that you won't ever see here, right? And they don't get the training, they don't get the education, they don't get that what all of the other 4% are getting. And I thought, well, if I really want to influence change in this industry, if I really want to make a difference in someone's life, like, this is actually it. There's 5,000 people working for my company right now that could use anything I can give them. And so I thought, well, and if I can influence 5,000 people, then the upward movement, like the rising tide, has got to be huge, right? If we can influence and change at this level, then it's just going to raise the bar all the way across for all the mom and pops and everybody. So maybe this is how we actually affect change, because affecting change at the top of 4% is the trickle down isn't happening, but maybe it's the movement up. So I took
even the that kind of ripple effect within the company itself, like if you train one office and then you move on to the next office, I presume that's how it works because it's such a big company, but the office that you've then trained, hopefully the guys that really understand what you were teaching can teach the other guys that maybe didn't quite get some of the points that you were teaching, and then it almost has like a ripple effect within the company of them teaching each other as well. So
absolutely, and the utility community is fairly small. It's a big community, but they're fairly tight-knit. Like, it's funny because utility arborists and residential arborists rarely hang out, which I don't understand, but they don't. They look at each other as two separate species, but we're all arborists doing arborist stuff, right? And so, but they still communicate to people outside their who they're employed with, but, you know, outside their circle, and they're teaching and training. They're like, oh, dude, I just learned this greatest thing. And so, yeah, the ripples start to get huge. And I've been there about a year, just like almost a year and a half. And I can tell you, like, the first, one of the hardest things was recognizing that, you know, this is not a ship that can be turned. You know, there's processes that need to happen. And so for me, that was probably the greatest challenge, was pumping the brakes. Because if you're in a seven-person company, and you want to affect a policy change, you walk in the office and you're like, today we're going to start with this. We're going to do training on it. Everyone's going to sit down. We're going to go out and do this. And, you know, it's going to cost a few $1,000 and we're good. And for me, like, so here's like, we wanted to implement friction savers, right? Just fimble savers. So we thought, well, what are we going to do for fimble savers? Well, we had to write a policy and a procedure that had to be reviewed by the risk department and the safety department and the lawyers, and then it had to be made so, right? And then there was a panel involved in that, and then we had to write a safe use policy, right? So you wrote a policy and procedure on what it was and how it worked, and then you wrote a policy on how to use it, and then you had to go out and buy them. So if you're thinking like in sheer numbers, and this isn't the true number, but if you're thinking a random number, let's say I had to buy 3,000 friction savers, right, at $90 a pop. So now we're hundreds of thousands of dollars, and we haven't trained anybody yet. We haven't even started yet. And then you got to take that into the field, and you got to teach each person at so many hours per person to understand it. And then now you start really doing the math, and you're like, this is overwhelming. And you can understand why it's so slow, because you have to be sure this is where you want to go, because you're investing millions of dollars to do a friction saver. And you and I are looking at each other like, it's a friction saver, dude. Yeah. Like, you just do it.
Yeah.
But you don't. You don't just do it. And so that's, like, for me to understand that concept of how much more is involved in making that. Because you have to make it, if there's 4,000 people, you have to make it understandable to 4,000 people. And I can't stand in front of all 4,000 people. So I've got to rely on people in the middle to be that source of information. So the message has to be 100% concrete and consistent. And so how do you write a policy and procedure that covers all the gray areas, but is super easy to train and recognize and super easy to grasp? And you're like,
that's a big task.
Yeah.
That's a big, and especially like for something like a fimble saver, which is a basic bit of equipment, if you were to then write policies for, you know, who knows, like
SRS.
SRS climbing, like, so you've got the whole system. And I know, so I worked at Bartlett when they were writing their single rope policy for their workers to be able to use it. And obviously they're like, right, well, we need, it can only be one system. We're going to use a rope wrench, and it has to be used with this hitch cord, and then the base anchor has to be this type of base anchor, and it's like no deviation from any of this. Like, and as an individual and as a tree climber, you're like, what, I can't use a different base anchor? But because a company of that size has to have a policy, and it has to be black and white. It can't be like, oh, well, if you have this bit of a kit, maybe, like, then you can use it, but it has to be inspected. But then if you don't have that bit of kit, you can use the bit of kit that we have, and like, it has to be black and white. So it's tough for bigger companies. So is that what you, like, one of your main jobs is to write policies of like evolving techniques and that kind of stuff?
Yeah, for sure. Honestly, my main job is to, so going back just a minute where I was saying before, so Will asked me, he's like, well, what do you want to do? And so I said, yeah, I'll do this. And when I left the company in the mid-90s and came back a year and a half ago, nothing had changed. Like, it was literally like stepping into the greatest time warp ever. Like, it was the same harness, same closed system hitch. Like, there were still teams out there in areas that were still spiking every single tree. And so I was just like, this might be exactly what I need to do to help. So yeah, my first initial thought was, what can we do to get people so they're using new tools, new equipment, so they're enjoying tree work, so it's not so hard, because the way they're doing it is soul crushing, right? And I just, what can I do to provide some sort of relief to the person in the field? And then my other job would be to find a team of people, surround myself with a team of people that can deliver the message really well. So we need to find trainers. And traditionally within a company that size, and you were at Bartlett, like, they have safety people. And generally safety people are people that, you know, were there long enough to, you know, not want to do anything else, not want to climb, but didn't want to like quit. So they got a job driving in a pickup, checking boxes, right? Which is great. We need auditors. We need people checking out to make sure I have enough cones and that all of this, but that doesn't help us grow people. And so my job is to find people that can help grow people. And that's my whole goal, is to build a team of trainers, not safety. I mean, we obviously safety is still paramount, but I want people to grow and learn and be
passionate about what they do.
Better.
Yeah.
And so we're there, that my goal right now is to recruit, train, and develop more trainers. And we've been very successful. We've been super blessed with some of the people that have come on board in the last couple of months, and we're looking forward to moving that forward. And in the interim, we're implementing things like hitch climbers and thimble savers and harnesses that don't have 4Ds. And, you know, we've implemented a lot of new equipment, and SRS is becoming very realistic all the way across the U.S. So we are winning, but it's such a big, huge ship to turn.
And so is Right Tree service all over the state?
42 states, and then we're in quite a bit of Canada now. So we're in BC, and we're in Alberta and that area. So probably.
And do you travel a lot with work, or I'm still
traveling a bit with work, but another difference between, you know, Nats is amazing and everything I was doing with Nats was amazing, but my schedule was dictated by the client. Because if you, Dan Holliday, wanted training, you'd call me up and you'd say, hey Phil, I want training, and I'd say, great, what topic or whatever, and we'd sort that out, and then you'd say, yeah, but I need it by this date. And I'd say, oh, well, I'd have to make that work. That's my calendar. Your calendar is my calendar. But working in an organization like Right Tree Service, if they call me up, they're like, look, we want SRS training in our area. I pull on my calendar and say, well, this is the first day I have available. They don't have any other choice because there's no one else competing with me.
They're working with your schedule. Yeah,
because there's no other Nats out there to train them. They have to follow. So that takes a huge amount of pressure, because I can be like, yeah, no. You know, I'll generally try to be considerate and say, when are you thinking? Give me a time frame. And then I'll be like, well, you know, I got my daughter's recital this day or whatever, so we're going to do it 3 months out, and that has to be okay, which is huge. Big difference.
So you so now you've been doing training for quite a number of years, and you went through a train the trainer. Do you almost feel like that's going to be a big part of your role at Wrights now? Like you're saying, you were trying to recruit safety people for kind of each office or whatever. So are you going to then train them how to project a message to their crew and that kind of
so
stuff?
So we divide into divisions, areas per se, and people generally work within their area. We do pull people around. That's something kind of new that we're doing, because I feel like if you keep seeing the same person over and over, the message becomes diluted. You know, if you work at a company long enough, even though the guy you thought was a rock star the first year, after the third year hearing the same story about his arm and a tree, you quit listening, right? So you need to hear it from a different perspective. And so we want to make sure that we have fluidity that way. But yeah, so right now what we're doing is, traditionally, as I said, we'd have people that were in the utility 10, 15, 20 years, and were kind of okay at what they did, but they were never really great, and then they retire into safety because safety is easy, and so that's who was doing this. And so right now we're actively, aggressively seeking high-level, proficient climbers so that we can only have to teach them how to train, not how to climb, rig, and train. And so we've been really lucky with that, because people are picking up on the message that's what we're trying to do. I think people are excited by the idea to be a part of something different.
Yeah, if they can see that is the ultimate goal, and a company is putting so many resources into safety and training, then that is a good thing to be a part of. Yeah. Even if it's a huge company, to know that that's the goal of the company, because it can get so, safety and training can get so forgotten about in big companies, because they can be all just about making money.
Yep.
So if the company has brought you on and then is implementing this stuff, then that says a lot about the company, that's for sure.
It's that old, like, can you put a price on safety, right? And people, you know, in all my experiences doing training from Nats to Right Tree Service even, you know, people will be like, well, you know, they'll call me up and they'll say, hey, you know, we need some training in chainsaw or felling. And, you know, training is the most important. It's the number one priority of the company. It's the number one most important thing, and you can't put a price on it. And then you talk some more, and then they're like, so how much is that going to cost? And you're like, you know, $1,500. They're like, whoa, that's expensive. Now, wait a minute. You just literally put a price on safety, didn't you? You put a $1,500 price tag on safety, right? Or if you're wearing a hard hat instead of a helmet, you know, and a hard hat, every time you look up and it falls off your head, and should never be worn by a climber in a tree, right? It just doesn't make any sense to me because it doesn't provide a level of protection. But if I'm talking to you about, and I give you all the great benefits of a helmet over a hard hat, and you look at me and you say, yeah, but it's $70 more, you just put a price on safety and you didn't know it. And so what I think Wrights is attempting to do, and it's not everybody all at once, but it's slowly happening, is that they're realizing that you really can't put a price on safety, and the return on investment far outweighs the initial investment once you get going, because once you have the culture and the buy-in, people will do more with less to make sure that you can accomplish the goal. When everyone feels like they're cared for, they care for you. And a lot of times, like you said, in the big companies, it just becomes that grind of like, you say you care, but you don't. Like, you show me, you talk one thing, and then you completely show me another. And I think the biggest thing that's happening right now within the organization that I'm in is that they're actually 100% showing the fact that this is what we're doing, and here's how, and here's the proof. Like, they can see it. The new harnesses are coming in, new ropes are coming in, SRS, and then I'm bopping around the country training, and then we got all these new people coming on board with amazing skill sets and great passion, and they're providing the message too.
And it's another way as well to how to retain your employees, because tree work, the turnover rate of employees is pretty high, especially in big companies. And if you can create a company that is an enjoyable company to work for, and you can see that the company actually cares about you, then you'll be able to retain more employees and not have that like headache of always looking for new people, because people are always leaving, which is probably with a big tree company, it's probably the number one stress that they have, is that they're always losing employees and always looking for new ones.
Employee retention is definitely one of those huge factors, because you know the value of an employee that stays for 1 year, it's they're worth more than five employees that left in 6 months. And so there's actually numbers. I can tell you exactly what it costs to make before you start making money off an employee, which is sad, but big companies figure that out because the turnover rate is so high. And I think you're 100% correct. So one of the things that I always teach when I was with Nats and when I'm with Wright, you know, number one thing, I think the message is people really don't work for money. They work for people. They work for what they care about, and they align with whatever the core values of the company are. So if you have good core values and you care about people, they'll return that. But if the dollar's most important, then you're going to have people that work for a dollar, and a dollar is easy to find somewhere else, right? So I think that's the number one thing, is people don't care what you know until they know you care, and you've got to provide that sense of family, sense of community, because that's what people want, really. And show them that. Don't lip service the heck out of it, right? Show them, like, I'll stay here all night with you until you get this, right? Whatever training thing we're working on, I'm here. And I think that's the real value. And, you know, sending them to training and all this other stuff is, because if you're paying someone to work for you, you'll get exactly what you pay for, right? But if you have someone that works with you, they'll blood, sweat, and tears to the end of the day.
Yeah, that's so true. So true. You say that that Wrights do residential and utility work. Do you, obviously the training is different because one is there's the electrical factor in there, but aside from that, do you have to train them in different ways, like, or do you train them to use the same climbing systems? Do you is everything the same apart from taking out the electrical?
No, so our residential service company is based just in Des Moines in Nebraska, and they've been kind of left to be a little bit more open with their policies since they're smaller and it's more manageable like a typical mom and pop tree company. So they've been using SRS techniques for a while, and they have more advanced harnesses, and they definitely have more advanced rigging tools, where the tree service, the line clearance side of things have definitely not been giving that kind of rain. And I think for me, what I come to understand, it's just about aspect of control, span of control, right? Like it's really, at the time, there weren't enough people in the organization that understood what SRS was or any of that. So they were very hesitant to release it, because how are they going to teach anybody or write a policy? It's they don't understand it themselves, so how can they even begin to give it to anybody else? And so they just continue to stay within that super awesome comfort zone because nobody steps outside of, and like I said, utility and residential don't seem to play well for some reason, so they wouldn't step outside their box. And the utility side of things, the safety and training side of things on the utility side, just stayed where they were really comfortable and happy with the 4D harness and the Arborplex rope and the Blake's hitch, and mind-blowing, really.
And I suppose the safety and training with the utility side, there's such a danger there from the electrical hazards that that's probably always the forefront of their training. So to like evolve their climbing systems is probably like forgotten about almost, because they're so focused on the electrical hazard that that's what they're going to train for.
Like. Yeah, exactly. And I think the utility focus is definitely on the electrical side, and because there's not generally a lot of structures underneath. So rigging is actually fairly minimal if you think about the utility side of things, because you generally, all you're rigging around is that one little quarter inch wide wire. And once you're past that, generally there might be a fence or something, but there's no houses. There's not a lot of structures, right? And then, so it's a different set of rigging. And then from a climbing perspective, you're only climbing one half of the tree. So really, is it really that inefficient to just go up on a Blake's hitch, on a monkey fist? And because you're really literally just pruning, it might not even be one half, it might be a quarter of a tree. And so the need to be able to redirect 16 times through a canopy isn't something that occurs very often in the utility market. So there is a different aspect of training, one from a safety side, but two, just from how you view a tree. Because think about, if every tree you looked at, you only looked at a quarter of the tree, right? 90% of what's in your kit, you just leave in the kit because you wouldn't need it today, right? I don't need all the slings and redirects and, right? I just need to go up, move around laterally, maybe 20, 30 feet sometimes or less, and then come back down. It's just, it's a different way to look at a tree. But when I'm looking at that tree and I'm picking tie-in points, it's completely different than a residential market where I'm going for that high center tie-in point so I can work more of the canopy, or I'm looking at all my different redirects. And for utility, all I'm looking at is that if I screw up, am I going to swing away from the power lines or not, right? And so you look at even choosing a tie-in point aspect is completely different mindset.
Yeah. And have you had to learn a lot of this, or were you familiar with utility work beforehand?
Yeah, so when I started, my whole career for the first 7 years in the early 90s was all utility, and then I left. So when I started, it was literally a 40 harness Arborplex rope. Actually, I started on 3-strand with a 2-over-1 suicide taut line and a pair of spurs, and that's what we climbed with. So you walked all the way to the top of the tree, and then you tied in, and then you worked the tree. It was totally free climbing, and we didn't even have hand saws. We did everything I had an 038 Farm Boss as my trim saw with a 14-inch bar. Like, that's how we did tree work. And so I recognize all of those different things and what they're doing, and I can kind of see it. But, you know, we still need to, that's still hard work physically on the people. So we got to advance it. We got to make it comfortable. There's nothing fun about putting on a 4D harness and tying in.
No.
It hurts a lot, for sure.
But like you say, it's going to be a slow implementation. Well, but
yeah, and I think some of it's because of natural resistance to change. But again, if I walked into your company and said, look, this harness is junk, and you have two harnesses to choose from, and they're either $400 or $500, and you know, there's four of you, you're like, $2,000, that sucks a lot, but that's a day's wage. And then say 4,600 harnesses, right? And then you're like, well, okay, we'll budget for that, we'll bank for that, we'll buy 4,600 harnesses. So you call up Cheryl Tree, or you call up Teufelberger, you call up whoever you call, Bartlett, whatever, and you're like, I need 4,600 harnesses. Guess what they're gonna tell you? Well, that's great. So you got 9 months to deliver them all? Because, you know, I got to call.
Because we're not making them that fast.
We're not making them that fast. And there's still all these other people that want them. So then there's that whole projected time to get them in. So like, looking at an implementation of gear, it also, you have to look at an honest time frame to even provide the equipment. It's so different than anything I've ever done before.
It's awesome. Sounds like a new challenge for you, Phil.
It is, but it's a good one.
It's good. keeps you on your toes.
Yeah, keeps me young.
Awesome. Well, thanks for sitting down and chatting with me for a bit, and really appreciate it.
I appreciate it very much,
really,
man.
Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Are you doing any more talks at the TCI?
Yeah, I got a talk tomorrow called "From Tree to Truck," on the trade show floor at 1 o'clock, and it's kind of looking at. So I did this as I've traveled around in my years with Nats and my years with, and just my. Well, the time I've had with Wright, what I've realized is that a lot of times what happens is that people are getting promoted into positions, either sales or safety or middle management operations stuff. And what we're not providing them any tools to transition to that role. And if you think about who we are as arborists, like, you know, as I said, we identify ourselves with our ability to, we are tree climbers, that's what we do. And then all of a sudden I stick you in a truck for 8.5 hours, right? And you're driving around, you're socially, you're not, it's not the same. Because when you're with the crew, you joke around, that's your family, that's your tribe, right? And every day you have a goal and you reach that goal, like the sense of
the accomplishment, the
dopamine,
the
right? Yeah, and when you're riding around a truck for 8 hours and everyone's talking to you and usually it's not positive, what's your sense of accomplishment? You don't feel like the only thing you're satisfied about is putting in a park at the end of your driveway, right? And physically, what starts to happen is you start to gain weight and you start to get sore and stiff and broken down. And all this feeds into this mental mora, right? This mental diabolical where you become depressed and you're not sure what depression is because you've never done that before. And so it's a conversation about, I looked at from talking with lots of arborists, like what are the 5 things that really totally kick your butt when you transition from working every day in the field as a production arborist to driving around in a pickup truck, whatever that role is. What are the things, 5 biggest things that happen that totally frustrate you? Time management, right? Like when you become salary, and then you're answering your phone at 6 o'clock at night, and then 7 o'clock at night, and then 8 o'clock at night, and then Saturdays, and then Sundays, where if you're a production arborist, right? Generally at 5 o'clock or if in the summer and 3 o'clock in the winter, when I clock out, I'm done. I go home. I'm off the clock. And unless I volunteer to work for a Saturday, I don't hear from you again until Monday. And, you know, so it's time management. It's the mental aspect of staring out a windshield all day. It's not having a sense of community. It's not having a sense of satisfaction or a sense of purpose because there's no job well done. There's no goal for you to accomplish. And it's the sense of losing that aspect of yourself of being this production, this awesome physical specimen, and now you're 45 pounds overweight and you're buying 7 pant sizes bigger than you were, and all you can do is complain about it, and then you just, it's just that vicious cycle, right? So what can we do to arm people before they get there with tools that they need to start thinking about to make it successful? Because we want them to be successful. We don't all need to climb for the rest of our lives. But in order for us to win, we have to recognize that this is not the same. And just because you were the greatest climber I have, doesn't mean that I hand you a set of keys and put you in a pickup truck and now you're the greatest operations manager, because you might be a terrible leader and a terrible communicator. You might be really good at climbing trees and being on the job, but you might totally suck with people. And so it's just recognizing who should do it and then giving them the tools to win. So I'm really stoked about it. It's fun.
That sounds like an awesome topic, because I've had that conversation with a bunch of people. I had a conversation with a guy today who was telling me he started doing sales, put on 45 pounds, was just driving around and wasn't having the fun that he had when he was at work. And like, we had that exact conversation. So that's really cool. Cause I've been through those few stages, and I know the sales part, and I know driving from client to coffee shop to client to coffee shop to get some lunch to client to, and that's how the day goes, and not having that, the banter between you and all your fellow colleagues, and now I notice that even more because of the center headsets. We literally laugh and joke and talk all day long just because we have the headsets on and we can talk, and then when we need to explain what we're going to be doing and doing some rigging, that's part of the conversation. But the majority of the time it's just, what were you doing this weekend and all that kind of stuff. And that's something you don't even think about, what you would miss if you went into the sales. You don't have that big part of your work kind of the work life at that point. So
yeah, and that, and having the same conversation you have with that gentleman, I've had with hundreds of really good arborists who are like, yeah, I just, it was just so unhappy with my life and myself, and I'm this is it, I'm in it, and I can't go back. They none of them believe they can go back. They're like, oh, if you'd only shown me that 10 years ago, I'd still be climbing trees. And it's like, no, like you can, we can all win. And so, yeah, and you know, I think one of the things I do towards the end of the talk is I have all the climbing arborists stand over here and all the people that are in the pickup truck stand over here. And then, you know, I'm like, basically, what if you could ask these guys any question you wanted, because you know you're going to end up here, what would it be? And then these guys, I'm like, so if you could give any piece of advice, what would it be? And then I let them think about it, and then I put them together and actually have them interact.
Awesome.
Because that's when do you get an opportunity to actually, you know, you don't. In the day-to-day grind, you don't think about saying, hey, if I were going
to
be
speak
you.
Speak to your future self. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that's what, that's
so
awesome.
So it's a lot of, it's a, I think it's I like a lot that. Of fun, and like it's an that. Under, it's an under talked about topic. It's like the quiet, I don't know, we brush it under the rug, but when you look around and start, you can look around and say, all right, yep, you're riding in a truck, you're riding in a truck, because their whole demeanor says it.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah. That's wicked. What time's that?
1:15, I think. Nice. Yeah, at the tree.
Yeah. Cheers, well, there. Really appreciate you giving it your time, Phil. That's awesome. And yeah, thank you.
Appreciate it, man. Yeah, man. Talk soon.
Thank you to Phil for giving up his time. I really appreciate it. The TCIA Expo was absolutely crazy, so it's really kind of him to take some time out of his day and give up some time to do the podcast with me. Hope you guys enjoyed just hearing a little bit of story about Phil and his career. Thank you very much, Phil. Great conversation. Awesome. This podcast was also brought to you by Jobber Business Software. Jobber is a business software that helps me run my own business, and it's been fantastic since I implemented it. It makes everything more streamlined. It makes me more organized as a person. It makes me not forget to invoice jobs like I used to do. So I can really get behind Jobber as a product. It's been absolutely fantastic for me, and it will continue to be a really great service. So of the listeners of this podcast, Jobber are offering a 14-day free trial, and then if you like it and you want to sign up after the free trial, you can get 20% off your first 6 months subscription. So that's a 14-day free trial, and then 20% off your first 6 months subscription if you really enjoy it and you want to sign up. Just go to climbingarborist.com, and you'll see a Jobber image across the top banner. Just click on that, and that will take you through to the link to get you that offer.